time never moved so slowly for me as it did after Yoshi Yamashiro's visit. I was locked in the brig of a ship that was about to go to battle against the most powerful navy in history. If the secessionists won, the Confederate Arms and MOGATs would agree that it was time for me to die. If the Unified Authority carried the day, Huang might execute me. I tried to sleep, but found that I could not lie still on my cot. Sam came in to check on me every hour. He stood outside my cell and stared in at me.
You want something?
Comfortable?
You want to come in and fluff my pillow?
You know, Harris, I used to want to shoot you. After seeing what they did to you in the interrogation room, I'd rather keep you alive. I might enjoy giving you the wand a time or two myself.
Why don't you come in here and we can discuss it?
You might show me some respect after what happened last time. Maybe I went too easy on you.
Oh, I'd love to go another round. Maybe this time you can hit me when I'm looking.
Watch yourself. Things could go worse for you next time. I wonder how that wand would feel if you went in with a broken jaw.
Let's find out. Why don't you come in here and break it?
The next person to call on me was Admiral Halvorsen. As he had before, Halvorsen came bearing gifts. This time, he carried a small red visor on a two-legged stand. The unit was no more than 18 inches tall, wobbly support frame and all. Sam accompanied him. In the Admiral's wake, the jailer acted more civil.
Got a visitor, Harris.
Hello, Colonel.
What is that?
This? Oh, this is how sailors used to view their battles 40 years ago, back when this ship was made. This is a remote strategic display.
Halvorsen walked to the door of my cell and placed the display on the floor.
Oh, be careful with it, Harris. It's an antique.
So you really plan to attack Earth today? Doesn't that seem a bit suicidal? The Doctrinaire will be waiting.
I'm counting on it. I should hope that the Unified Authority's most powerful ship will come to protect its capital world. Believe it or not, Harris, we've sped up our plans because of you. Ever since you arrived, we seem to have lost the element of surprise. So now, thanks to you, we have very little choice but to finish the war.
May I?
Halvorsen nodded. I stepped off the cot and walked over to the door of the cell. Kneeling rather than bending over, so that I could keep an eye on Sam, I reached through the bars and picked up the display. The thing weighed no more than a pound. The visor itself was made of cheap, hollow plastic.
The display is monochrome, I'm afraid. It's red against black. Old technology, but it's the best I could find.
I can't watch from the bridge?
Harris, I don't know how you tipped Huang off, but resourceful as you've proven yourself to be, I wouldn't trust you anywhere near the bridge.
So, you think you can win? You have what, roughly 600 ships? Didn't the Galactic Central Fleet have about 600 ships? That was before Thurston blasted four of them at Little Man.
Some of the fleet is too old or too badly maintained to fight. And they've shot down 17 more of our ships since you came aboard, Harris. We're down to 540. Well, 539.
Did you hear what Huang said about a fleet with no fighters?
That it's like a boxer without a jab? He doesn't know what he's talking about. The man's a politician, not a sailor. He puts on a good show.
Not as good a show as Thurston, though. You were crazy to kill Kleiber. Did you really think you could stop the Doctrinaire by killing Kleiber? Didn't it ever occur to you that Huang would replace him with Robert Thurston?
Harris, Bryce Kleiber was a personal friend. But this is war. I hated killing Bryce, but I need Thurston in his place.
Thurston is a better strategist than Kleiber ever was. You were there when Kleiber tried to match him in a simulation.
Kleiber was more dangerous for our purposes. I've served under both officers. Thurston's style is tailor-made for us.
You're crazy. Robert Thurston is the best commander in the UA Navy.
Under most circumstances.
But you didn't need to kill Kleiber. Huang took the ship away from him at the summit. He gave Thurston the Doctrinaire and moved Kleiber to the support fleet.
They moved Kleiber to the support fleet. I learned about the transfer after the cable was set. But by the time I heard about it, it was already too late. Too late. Enjoy the show, Harris.
I had heard about strategic displays, like the one Tom Halvorsen gave me. Sailors used to call them Red Worlds. This was not the obsolete strategic views replaced by the 3D holographic displays used in modern ships. This was a portable display that officers could take into engineering or battle stations. The visor was about 3 inches thick. Inside its housing was a laser that could draw objects in brilliant detail. The only problem was that it could only draw them in one color. red. My eyes never did adjust to that red and black display. I switched on the power and pressed my face into a soft foam ring that ran along the inside of the visor. A little sign appeared instructing me to adjust the eyepieces to the shape of my face. Using two knobs built into the top of the visor, I adjusted the display until the words in that sign seemed to float out in space. The display showed a satellite view of Earth. I could see the side of the planet facing the sun. In the display, the lasers drew clouds and land in red. The ocean was black and hollow. The edge of the moon was barely visible in the right corner of the display. In the lower corner, a digital clock counted backward. The clock read 000537. When the clock reached 000100, the visor blanked out. It went dead for just a moment, then winked back to life, and I knew that we had just broadcasted into Earth space. In the red and black panorama, the fabric of space around the moon seemed to shatter as 540 self-broadcasting ships appeared just behind the moon. Turning my attention to Earth, I saw hundreds of ships rising from all points on the globe and forming a blockade. The Doctrinaire was nowhere among them. There were Perseus-class fighter carriers, battleships, and destroyers. I zoomed out to see a wider perspective. From this angle, the UA ships looked no more significant than specks of dust in a sandstorm. As I closed my perspective, the UA ships took on shape and detail. Panning in so close that I could make out the Rocky Mountains, I studied the Earth Fleet's formation. I watched as an endless stream of fighter jets sprayed out of carrier flight tubes. Even this close in, the fighters were nothing more than motes as they flew into formation and moved to the front of the fleet. The Hinode ships were still grouped around the moon, some 240,000 miles away. The two fleets would only need a minute to cross the 200,000 miles between the Earth and moon. Pressing another button changed my battle perspective so that I could now get a closer look at the Hinode ships. Fine vector lines traced the edges of the ships. There were only three kinds of ships in the Hinode fleet: cruisers, destroyers, and battleships. When I switched back to the Earth fleet, I did not like what I saw. The fleet could have used Kleiber at the helm. It looked untried and unready for battle, or perhaps simply unready for this battle. Whoever was in command of the fleet had placed the frigates near the front of the formation, just behind the fighters, a textbook formation for a different battle. The UA did not need frigates, a class of ship designed specifically to combat fighters. The Hinode fleet had capital ships and no fighters. I saw this and realized Che Huang had undoubtedly installed himself as fleet commander.
Good going, Huang.
In the bottom corner of the display, the clock now counted forward. 6 minutes had passed since the enemy ships broadcasted into Earth space. The Hinode ships spread their ranks and started forward. One of the old cruisers, however, seemed to have stalled. It inched forward, limping behind the other Hinode ships in stuttering short bursts. This had to have been the 540th ship, the one that Halverson doubted would be in on the battle. I might have thought that it was the command ship, but I was on the command ship. I would have felt that kind of engine problem. The Earth fleet had 20 carriers with 1,400 fighters. Those fighters dashed forward and splashed across the front of the advancing Hinode formation, parting in every direction and breaking into its ranks. The visor lit up as thousands of short-range lasers and cannons opened fire, and still the Hinode ships advanced, closing in on Earth. But where was the Doctrinaire? The battle had begun. The front ranks of the Hinode and Earth fleets were almost within range, and the barrage began. Missiles and long-range beams filled the air. I could not tell the difference between particle beams and lasers on this display. I knew that the UA ships had both particle beams and lasers, and that the particle beams were far more destructive. Hinode ships had only lasers. And then it happened. First, the jagged shards of lightning appeared. I had never seen anything like the anomaly caused by the Doctrinaire. It was a huge, shimmering bubble, as big as any two ships on the field. On my visor, it showed in translucent red. Silver-white bubble, the bow of the Doctrinaire emerged. Huang was a better tactician than I gave him credit for. The cruisers were off on the edges to make space. As the anomaly began, the UA battleships cleared out of the way, and the Doctrinaire drifted into the void that they created. Even before it had fully emerged from its anomaly, the Doctrinaire began to fire. Its massive cannons lashed out quickly, appearing to pluck Hinode ships out of space. Across the battlefield, the reaction was immediate. Inode's ships scattered. They broke out of their offensive position and shot off in weaving, evasive threads. Several ships broadcasted away. From the corner of my eye, I noted the time. The battle had gone on for 9 minutes and 12 seconds. The entire Hinode fleet could broadcast to safety if it wanted. Because I took my eye off the battle for just a second to look at the clock, I almost missed the decisive blow. I saw the flash and zoomed in immediately. I was just in time to see the last of the lightning as it danced like St. Elmo's fire along the edges of the Doctrinaire. The great ship seemed to list, its bow dipping down and moving counterclockwise, as if preparing for some spiraling maneuver. Then the ship seemed to flinch. It grew brighter as light shined through its portals. Panels along its roof burst, unleashing folds of flame and vapor. Finally, the Doctrinaire, the great ship, the Leviathan, vanished in a glowing ball that hurled debris in every direction before collapsing on itself. I pulled my face out of the visor. I needed a moment to understand what I had seen. When I looked back, I saw the wreckage of the Doctrinaire hanging in space. It looked like a giant bird lying with its wings spread. The ship was utterly dark now, with not so much as a spark flashing. Only a handful of UA ships remained around the Doctrinaire. The destruction of the Doctrinaire brought even more ruin. Every ship around it was smashed. Now the Hinode fleet regrouped. It had lost a few ships at the onset of the battle. After the apocalypse of the Doctrinaire, the Hinode fleet suddenly had a huge numerical advantage. Most of the Earth fleet had been destroyed. Many of those UA ships that survived the destruction were so badly damaged that they could hardly defend themselves as the Hinode ships renewed their attack. They had destroyed the Unified Authority's Goliath ship, but they had not made the galaxy safe for themselves. UA ships still patrolled Perseus, Norma, Cygnus, and Scutum Crux. They would certainly retaliate. I was so engrossed by the 3D battle that I barely noticed Yoshi Yamashiro outside my cell.
The war is over, Harris. Where did you get that display?
Halverson gave it to me. How did they do it? How did they destroy the Doctrinaire?
We should discuss that later.
I'm not sure how much later I have.
Yamashiro passed a package wrapped in brown paper through the bars. The package was approximately the same size as a folded flag. It was not soft, but it was bendable.
You will need to take care of the jailer yourself. We will be back in an hour.
Take care of Sam? How do you expect me to do that?
Let yourself out.
As he left the brig, I gave the door a tug. It slid open easily on its rollers. I caught it after less than an inch. There were security cameras all along the brig, three of which had views into my cell. Smiling to myself and trying to look away from the cameras, I returned to my cot. I could have slipped out of my cell and killed Sam in his office. I knew where it was. I visited it on my way to my cell the day I was captured. The problem was that in all likelihood, he would spot me. The security cameras had motion tracking.
You and I have a score to settle.
Instead of making me come to him, the Mogat jailer had come to me. Unfortunately, he also had a pistol in his right hand. That presented a problem.
You gonna shoot me?
Yeah, I suppose I am.
No trial?
Sam stuck his right hand, pistol and all, in through the bars. He aimed the pistol at me.
We have a problem. See, the Japanese think they won the war. They reconfigured the boats, you know, so they think they're in charge. And the Confederate arms? They think they won the war because Admiral Halverson came up with the idea of attacking Mars. They think they're in charge, too.
What about Mars?
You didn't hear? We destroyed the Mars broadcast station. Didn't know about that, huh? We turned out the lights on the rest of the galaxy. Now the whole UA military is dark and stuck in place.
It took me a moment to understand what Sam meant. At first, I thought he meant that the network provided power to the rest of the Republic. Then I realized that he meant that there would be no communications. Without the broadcast network, the outer fleets would not only be stranded, they would have no idea about what had happened.
Which brings me back to you. Halverson and the Japanese want to let you go free. Now, General Crowley, he knows what's what. He figures it's easier to get forgiveness than permission, if you know what I mean. He figures we shoot you now. Then if Halverson and the Japanese complain, we say something along the lines of, "Oops, we didn't know you'd care."
Suddenly, I sprang from the cot. Instead of lunging toward Sam, as he must have expected, I vaulted along the floor in the other direction. As I reached the end of the cell, I kicked. The heavy door slid along its track and crushed Sam's arm, which was resting in the bars. The gun fell from his hand.
You son of a
test tube!
Sam pulled his arm from the bars and charged forward. As he came toward me, I chopped into the side of his neck with the heel of my right hand. I stomped on his neck and snapped it. I dragged Sam into the cell and hoisted him onto the cot face down, then spread my blanket over him. Yamashiro's gift was a Japanese naval uniform. I slipped it on quickly. My hour was almost over. He would return for me. I did not know whether I should wait in my cell or hide in the jailer's office. Yamashiro answered the question for me when he and seven officers strolled into the corridor.
It appears as if we have interrupted an execution.
That was the general plan.
Stay close to us.
Where are we going?
Another ship.
As we got farther from the brig, more Japanese officers turned out to join us. We formed a solemn parade. While the rest of the ship celebrated, the Japanese marched quietly, gaining in number. By the time we reached the landing bay, where three transports waited, there were easily 200 officers in our ranks. While we officers boarded the transports, Yamashiro went to have a word with the Confederate officer running the landing bay. After a brief chat, Yamashiro returned, and the transport took off. The mood on the transport remained solemn.
What is going on?
Yamashiro sat beside me on the bench lining the outer wall.
The officers of the Hinode fleet are meeting for a victory celebration. We will have four battleships to ourselves.
Celebration? This looks more like a wake.
After a fashion. Like you, we are making our escape. The enemy will have several hundred ships. We will have four. We view this battle as a defeat.
You could not have planned all of this since last night.
We knew where we stood long ago. Long before you and I spoke. We have been planning our escape for months. One thing did come out of our conversation. I have long felt a debt to Admiral Kleiber. Had it not been for him, the Navy would have attacked Ezekri. He persuaded the Senate to settle with an occupation. When you tried to warn me, I decided to repay my debt by bringing you along.
The entire broadcast network would have shut down the moment a Hinode battleship fired its lasers into the Mars broadcast station. Now that the network was down, all fleets were stuck in the areas they were patrolling. The UA Navy ships could fly 30 million miles per hour, but that was still 1/6 the speed of light. And most inhabited planets were located thousands of light years apart from each other. The UA Navy had a fleet in the Scutum Crux Arm that could have defeated the Hinode fleet, but those ships were 10,000 light years away. Without the broadcast network, it would take those ships 60,000 years to reach Earth. Without the broadcast network, the galaxy was no longer a republic. It was a loose collection of inhabited planets. Throughout the six arms, there were only a very few instances in which any two inhabited planets were within traveling distance of each other. And then there was the question of communications. The disks worked as a transom, broadcasting and directing radio waves so that Earth could communicate across its empire. Now, even using laser messaging, it would take messages minutes just to reach Mars. In Scutum Crux, Sagittarius, and all the outer arms, Earth had suddenly gone silent. Most people would know that Hinode ships had attacked Earth. That was all they would know. Suddenly, every planet was alone in the universe. No fleet could hope to go beyond the territory it was currently patrolling. Struggling planets could never hope to receive support or supplies. Only the Allies, the Confederate Arms, the Mogats, and the Japanese could traverse the galaxy now that the broadcast network was destroyed. With the exception of small scientific craft designed for exploration, the UA's entire self-broadcast fleet was aboard the Doctrinaire. Now, the alliance between the Japanese, the Mogats, and the Confederate Arms was splitting. We reached our destination, and the four Japanese ships that made up the new Hinode fleet self-broadcasted away from the rest of the Confederate fleet. Yamashiro brought me to a conference room for a briefing.
The Second War has already begun. A battle has broken out between the Mogats and the Confederate arms. The Mogats have seized control of most of the fleet.
How can you know that?
We took a lesson from you and placed transmitters on every ship.
You bugged your own ships. But that would mean we were still nearby?
We are 5 million miles from the fleet. You might say we traveled a safe distance to listen.
Can't they detect you?
How would they do that? The broadcast network is no more.
And your transmitters have a direct link.
Even if the Morgan Atkins believers detected us, we would be able to broadcast away before they could reach us. But, as you might guess,
the Mogats and Confederates have bigger fish to fry.
I would say they are distracted at the moment.
So where does that leave me? Am I now a citizen of Shin Nippon?
I am sorry to inform you, Colonel Harris. My officers and I have discussed this, and we do not feel it would be advisable to bring a man of your destructive capacity to our planet.
You mean a liberator?
I mean a killer. Some of my men watched you kill your jailer. Liberator or natural born, you are a dangerous man.
I'm not the only killer. You and your men are wearing uniforms.
We are engineers. We modernize the ships and help fly them. The Mogats and the Confederates did all of the fighting. We never wanted to enter a war.
So this was just a reprieve.
I do not understand. We will take you wherever you wish to go, as long as it does not endanger our ship.
You're joking. Why are you helping me?
We owe a debt to...
Bryce Cliver. Yes, you mentioned that before. But you also showed a Mogat assassin how to kill Cliver by rigging his transport.
We had no choice. Admiral Harrison said that we could not have won the war if Cliver commanded the Doctrinaire.
I don't understand how that can be. I served under both Cliver and Admiral Thurston. I saw them square off in a battle simulation. Thurston ran circles around Cliver. Why was it so important that Thurston take command? From what I saw, you had something more powerful than the Doctrinaire all along.
Now that the battle has ended, I suppose there is no reason for this to remain a secret. I understand Admiral Harrison loaned you a portable display unit. Is that correct?
That's right.
When the battle started, one of our cruisers remained behind.
I thought about this and remembered a ship sputtering forward and falling behind the rest. I assumed it had mechanical problems. Then, as the battle progressed, I forgot all about it.
That was the weapon.
That cruiser destroyed the Doctrinaire?
Admiral Cliver was a very aggressive commander. He would send his command ship into battle alongside his other ships. Robert Thurston was more of an organizer. With a super ship like the Doctrinaire, he preferred to shoot enemy ships as his support fleet herded them in his direction. Cliver would have flown the Doctrinaire as it was meant to be flown, like a gigantic battleship. Thurston used it like a floating fortress. Do you see now?
No.
Cliver would have flown his ship up and down the battlefield. Thurston remained in one place, destroying every ship that came within range. He remained in one place long enough for us to chart his position and...
You broadcasted that cruiser into the center of the Doctrinaire. Absolutely brilliant.
We placed a nuclear bomb on the bridge of the cruiser.
So the cruiser was a drone?
You can't self-broadcast a drone ship. You might lose control during the broadcast. We could not trust a drone ship, not with so much depending on it. We trained a crew of Morgan Atkins believers to fly a suicide mission.
A kamikaze mission? You trained kamikaze pilots? You taught a bunch of Mogats how to run their own broadcast computer? Did you give them some engineering tips?
Yes.
And they would have passed that information on to their friends. You won the war and made yourselves expendable. From here on out, the Mogats will be able to pilot their own ships.
Dressed in his suit and red necktie, his black hair brushed back and oiled, Governor Yoshi Yamashiro considered the alliances to which he had sold his soul. Whom did he hate more? The Confederate arms? The Morgan Atkins believers? The Unified Authority? Or himself?
We cannot fly you back to Earth. That entire system is a battle zone. Is there any place else you would like to go?
Any place? Take me to New Columbia.
I had a lot of reasons why I wanted to return to New Columbia. If I had to be stranded on a planet, being stranded on a planet with a large agricultural base and a small population was attractive. Thanks to the evacuation, New Columbia had far more food than people. Also, there was Ray Freeman. The last time I spoke with Freeman, he was headed to that very planet to meet with me. While he and I were not exactly friends, we were partners. I felt as connected to him as I did to any man in the galaxy. My other reason for wanting to go to New Columbia was my plane, the self-broadcasting Starliner I had borrowed from the Doctrinaire. The ship was mine now, free and clear. With the destruction of that great ship, no one even knew that Johnston Aerodynamics had ever built a self-broadcasting Starliner. Once I had the Starliner, I would no longer be stranded on New Columbia, assuming it survived the attack. From the bridge of the Hino Day battleship, a deck officer took a satellite scan of Safe Harbor and reported to Governor Yamashiro.
The city was evacuated before the attack. It still appears mostly empty. The primary targets were all destroyed. I did locate a tank and some armored personnel carriers moving in the city limits. I also recorded a firefight.
Artillery?
Small weapons.
Are you certain this is where you want to go?
Yes.
Can we send a transport safely?
From what I can tell, there are no people around Safe Harbor Spaceport.
You think it's safe to land there?
I doubt anyone would even see us flying in. The spaceport is several miles out of town. Even if they pick up the transport on the way down, we should be able to lift off again well before anyone comes within 20 miles of us.
How does the airport look?
Undamaged. I don't think any looters have made it out there yet. It's pretty far from town and the roads were destroyed.
What about the Marine base?
Destroyed.
The Army base?
All primary targets were destroyed.
Maybe Callahan was dead. Even as I thought this, a voice deep in my head scoffed at the idea. About an hour later, my transport touched down on the tarmac. The air was still and humid on the tarmac. It was a warm night, lacking so much as a simple breeze. Judging by what I saw around me, there was not so much as a stray vault of electricity anywhere in the spaceport. The buildings stood mute and dark like mountains with unnaturally straight cliffs. The runway stretched out before me, vast and smooth. I ran its length with little fear of tripping. The stark white walls of the hangars looked dark gray as I passed them. I found the hangar that housed my Starliner and entered. It was dark in the hangar, and I walked forward slowly, hands in front of my face. I found the smooth, rounded metal of a spaceship. It was almost too large a ship to be in this hangar. My Starliner was big by private ship standards, but it wasn't as big as this ship. This ship was tall and bulky. Brushing my hand along its nearly vertical hull, I felt my way around the floor. I could not be sure in the dark, but I felt confident that I recognized this ship. Once again, I felt my way through the darkness, walking slowly and blindly. Not far from the first ship, I found the edge of a diagonal wing belonging to a second ship. I followed that wing toward the front of the Starliner. Punching my security code into the pad, I unlocked the hatch. Now I found myself on familiar ground. I flipped a switch and lights turned on around the cabin. I switched on the landing lights and had a look at the other ship. As I suspected, it was Freeman's ship. He had come this far. I had not known whether or not he had made it to Safe Harbor before the Confederate Navy destroyed the broadcast network. Freeman must not have realized that my Starliner was self-broadcasting, or he would have taken it. I slept in the Starliner that night. The chairs only reclined so far, but they were soft and comfortable. Safe Harbor Spaceport was 30 miles out of town. At the first light of day, I stole a car from a parking lot outside the passenger terminal and began the trip into town. The highway was in bad shape. There were massive craters every 100 yards or so, and burnt-out wrecks of vehicles were strewn about everywhere. I did not make it all the way to Safe Harbor before nightfall. Crossing the gullies and blown-out sections of road slowed me down. By late afternoon, I was only 2 or 3 miles from the outskirts of the city. I was close enough to see it clearly, but I did not want to travel into that urban tangle in the darkness. As the sun set and the sky took on streaks of amber, orange, and gold, I set up camp just inside the forest and ate an MRE that I had scrounged from the Starliner. Once night fell, I looked at the distant city. No lights shined in the tall buildings. Some glow rose from the street. There might have been fires in dumpsters and trash cans. Maybe a few small stores had gone up in flames. The glow suggested controlled fires, but you never knew. When morning came, I would make my way into the city. I would travel to Fort Washington, the stricken Marine base. I wanted combat armor. The sensors and lenses in a combat visor would help as I searched for Freeman and Callahan. In the morning, I ate another MRE and finished the hike into town. The last time I came into Safe Harbor, the city was empty but perfectly preserved, like a museum exhibit. Now it more truly fit the profile of a ghost town. Looters had gutted the small stores on the outskirts of town. Some buildings were burned down. There had been few cars along the street on the night of the attack. Now I found cars parked in the middle of the streets. These cars must have been found, driven dry, and abandoned. Not that I was in any position to condemn car thievery. Safe Harbor had become a patchwork of prime city and war zones. A few blocks into town, I walked into a neighborhood that had probably survived the Hino Day attack, only to be sacked and destroyed by gangs. This had been an upscale residential area with 2- and 3-story apartment buildings, parks with playgrounds, and hedges along the sidewalks. Hino Day lasers had not done this damage. The streets were intact, but there were bullet holes everywhere. The windows and doors of the apartment buildings were broken in. Some buildings had been gutted by fire. The windows of these buildings were blackened from smoke. Beds, toys, and clothing littered the streets. The people who sacked this neighborhood had taken everything they wanted, then, in an anarchic feeding frenzy, destroyed everything they did not want. I heard the gunfire on the outskirts of the financial district, an area filled with monolithic skyscrapers that seemed to slide out of the sky. The financial district stretched on for blocks, 3 square miles of city real estate covered by 50 and 60 floor buildings with marble facades and glistening windows. The looters would certainly have come into the financial district, but they could not break these inch-thick windows with simple bricks, and they would not waste bullets trying to decorate this part of town. Some of the buildings had protective louvers across their entries. The looters would need to find better tools before they could enter these buildings. They would need lasers or explosives. A few blocks into the financial district, I located the remains of an army checkpoint. I smelled the destruction long before I saw it. The scents of decay, dust, and fire became stronger. Then I turned a corner and confronted it. The men who erected the barricade had prepared to face looters, not battleships. A few laser blasts had reduced their tanks and armored transports to slag. There was one spot in which a laser had dug a 6-foot pit in the middle of the street. The men guarding this checkpoint would have died at their post before deserting. They were government-issue clones, heavily programmed and damned near incapable of abandoning an assignment. I continued on. From here on out, I would travel through smaller streets and alleyways. As long as I continued heading north and east, I would end up somewhere near Fort Washington. When Ray Freeman arrived in Safe Harbor, the Marine base was the first place he would have visited. After another hour, I found my way into a retail district. Going from the deserted financial district into a retail section was like stepping out of a forest and finding yourself in a pasture. I moved through alleys, working my way around pallets and layers of trash that carpeted this portion of town. Moving through the empty streets of Safe Harbor, the hum of an engine sounded as foreign to me as the roar of a dinosaur. If I had to guess, I would have said it was an armored transport from the Marines or Army. I switched from my M27 to my particle beam pistol as I peeked around a corner. Traveling from lot to lot, hiding behind walls and fences whenever I could, I worked my way forward. I tracked down the sound of that truck engine.
Hey guys, look at me. I'm a specking Marine. Careful with that. It's worth something.
This thing, I wouldn't want to wear it. It's got clone meat inside it. Clone probably rotted all over it.
I'm telling you, that helmet is worth something. That Marine combat armor? That's good shit.
Hey, if you don't want it, I'll take it. I'll give you $500 for it.
I did not recognize the voices. I knelt in a shadow to listen for clues about who these men were.
Money doesn't buy jack.
We might sometime.
Only if the government comes back. That happens, we're all screwed.
I'll trade you a canned ham for it.
Canned ham? No shit.
I peered around the corner of a building. looking into the plaza ahead of me. It did not look busy by any stretch of the imagination, but it was well trafficked. It looked like a downtown shopping district might look on a Saturday afternoon in a city that closed on weekends. Groups of men and women sat on walls or around a fountain. I recognized the canned ham boys immediately. They were the ones standing around the corpse of a Marine. The biggest of the men had stripped the helmet off of the dead clone and held it in his hands.
What's so good about this thing?
I could have used that visor. Also, I did not like seeing these grave robbers abusing the body of a fallen Marine. Looking around the plaza, I noted that all of the men were armed. Most had government-issue M27s. They must have taken these from dead soldiers and Marines. I wondered if looters had found their way to Fort Washington and how thoroughly they had picked over the base.
Why do you want this so badly?
No reason. I just like the look of it.
You wouldn't have offered a ham for it for no reason.
At the edge of the plaza, three men looked under the hood of an army supply truck. The truck's dark green paint stood out against the cement courtyard and slate fountain. Any number of warlords had probably carved up the city and claimed sections for themselves. I had located some warlord's stronghold. There were a couple of heavy caliber machine guns mounted on the front and back of the truck. But if that was the best this dime store daimyo could do, he and his tribe would not last long.
Throw in some chocolate bars and you can have it.
Yeah, I ate all my chocolate bars. How about a half box of Twinkies?
Shaking my head, I walked away from the sad scene. What if every city in the galaxy had degenerated this way? Had Washington, D.C. been carved up by a handful of self-appointed warlords? Maybe not. Maybe cities like Safe Harbor, cities that had been evacuated, collapsed more readily into anarchy. Cities that still had soldiers and police to keep the peace might be okay. As I reached the outer suburbs around Fort Washington, however, I discovered signs of a different disorder. Someone had claimed these streets, and I had a pretty good idea of who had done it. Someone painted the letters JC on signs and walls. Like a dog urinating to mark its territory, JC, possibly Jimmy Callahan, had painted graffiti around this part of town. On one large building, I saw JC Resurrection.
Resurrected? It has to be Callahan.
As the sun dropped on the horizon and the sky turned dark blue, I traveled the last mile to Fort Washington. Fort Washington was a large compound, encompassed by a chain-link fence and razor wire. No lights burned anywhere that I could see, but I saw the glow of fires around the grounds. Lasers or looters had destroyed much of the fence. Making one last inventory check, I knelt beside the chassis of an overturned bus, examining my pistol to be sure it was charged, and stole onto the base. The attack had left the base in ruins. Every building I passed was destroyed. The first building I saw was a barracks, an elongated brick dormitory for enlisted Marines. The building had caved in. As I walked around the base, I noticed large bundles hanging from the lower boughs of almost every tree. The bundles looked like rucksacks. They hung at the end of long leads of rope, dangling perfectly still, apparently so heavy that the low summer breeze did not move them. They were everywhere, hanging from the trees, from the rafters of the buildings, and two or three bundles hung from each street lamp. They were not rucksacks, of course. These were the Marines of Fort Washington. Pulling my flashlight from my pocket, I stole up to one of the streetlights. Three men dangled above me, two clones and an officer. The clones were clearly killed in combat. They had been stripped of their armor, but I could tell by the blistered skin of their faces and their charred bodysuits that they were killed by laser fire. Some grave robber must have found them while scavenging through the base. The officer, however, had not died during the raid. Someone had executed him, firing a single bullet into the side of his head from close range. I could see his tied hands through the bag. Shining my light on him, I saw that the top right corner of his head was a bloody hollow mess. These were Callahan's scarecrows, killed in action or put to death after the battle, it didn't matter. Jimmy Callahan strung up the bodies as a warning to other warlords that Fort Washington was his territory. If I looked around long enough, I might find Colonel Bernie Phillips hanging from a tree. There might have been 20,000 or even 30,000 men assigned to Fort Washington. Could Callahan and his men have strung up all of the bodies? I thought that many of the men killed during the attack would have been too torn up to hang, but that turned out to be wrong. Under a nearby tree, I saw a body without arms or legs or any of the familiar curves you associate with the human form. On closer inspection, I discovered that it was nothing but a bunch of body parts. Somebody had stuffed this fellow into nylon netting used for laundry. Like I said before, most of the base lay in darkness, but I got my first sense of life as I crossed over a small hill. I had no trouble locating where the noise came from. Off in the distance, a two-story building shone in a bath of incandescent light. Glare from that building illuminated the broken buildings around it. You could only describe Jimmy Callahan as a complete moron. Lying on the ground at the crest of a grassy hill, partially hidden by the six core corpses hanging above me, I could have picked off half of Callahan's army with a single shot had I brought a rocket launcher. They had lined up in a tight group for some kind of parade. The terrain he selected showed his lack of tactical training. He set up his headquarters in a building surrounded by hills. The hills formed a ring around him, giving me or any invading gang the high ground advantage. And then there was the light. Callahan felt compelled to show off to the world that he had a working power generator. The light from his headquarters illuminated his troops. I could see the men in the machine gun nests set up on the veranda. I had a much better view of the sharpshooters on the roof than they had of me. Although they had night for day scopes, they would need to locate me before they could aim and shoot. I could see them clear as day. A particle beam pistol, however, was not the right equipment for a sniper attack. It was a short-range weapon for killing people and blowing up targets within a 30-foot radius. So I lay silently at the base of a tree, hidden from view by dangling corpses, and I watched. Most of Callahan's men wore fatigues. Some carried M27s. Some carried pistols. I estimated Callahan's troops at somewhere between 150 and 200 men. He had jeeps and all-terrain vehicles and a few armored personnel carriers. How he had taken control of this territory with so few men, I could not understand. An LG tank rumbled up the street toward the lighted building. These units were made for use on planets with low gravity, obviously. Tell a marine engineer to make a tank heavier, and you can guess exactly what he'll do. He adds thicker armor, heavier guns, more durable treads, and more powerful motors. That was how Callahan became so powerful. Who or what could possibly stand up to that tank? I pulled out a pair of binoculars that I had grabbed while I was in the city. These were cheap, birdwatcher quality gear, but they gave me a better view. I could read the markings on the tank as it rolled to within a few feet of that lighted building. I was just lowering the binoculars when an officer stepped out of the building. For an odd moment, I thought it might be Colonel Phillips. I brought up the binoculars again. Jimmy Callahan, wearing one of Bernie Phillips' colonel uniforms, strutted down the stairs like a made man who owns the future. His arms swinging at his sides and his head held high, he surveyed his troops. He strutted around the tank, pretending to inspect it. I did not even need these lousy peeps to see the self-satisfied expression on Callahan's face.
See any reason why I shouldn't cap him?
He held a sniper's rifle in one hand and a rocket launcher in the other.
I don't see the point in it.
Looks like we're gonna be stuck on this planet for a long time, Harris. And I don't want Callahan for president.
So you're bringing democracy to New Columbia? What about the tank?
You worried about it?
Not especially.
I wasn't. I was more worried about the jeeps. In this gravity, the tank would rumble along so slowly that a 5-year-old could outrun it.
I didn't think so.
But I'm not worried about Callahan either.
Me neither.
200 yards below us, a misty red halo formed around Callahan's head, and he dropped to the ground. Two of Callahan's soldiers ran for a jeep. Freeman picked off the faster man before he reached the vehicle. He shot the second man as he tried to climb into the driver's seat. Only one of the guns fired even near our direction. Freeman shot that gunner first, and then he took out the other gunners in the other nest.
You hit her, watch or help.
You have things under control?
I picked up the rocket launcher and aimed at the tank.
You know what to shoot?
The tank?
Not the tank. The fuel depot.
Nice.
Without so much as a backwards glance, Freeman got up and started walking away, and I quickly followed.
You didn't have to kill Callahan.
I wanted to.
My Starliner is self-broadcasting. We can leave anytime that we want.
Self-broadcasting? We're getting off this rock.
It wouldn't have mattered if Callahan was president of the friggin' Orion Arm. He wouldn't have been able to touch us.
So, Killing him was a bonus.
After Freeman and I left the base, we found a house to hide out in while we figured out our next move. We were in a basement with only subterranean windows. We could see up and down the street from our ankle-high perspective. The street was dark and still, but we expected marauders to follow soon. Callahan's troops would come looking for us. So would his enemies.
How did you come through town?
On foot.
Did you cross main roads?
Alleys, mostly. I hiked through a couple of department stores to avoid being seen.
The main roads are broken up. We'd end up driving through the neighborhoods.
We would be sitting ducks. There are gangs everywhere. All it would take is some hotshot with a roadblock and a bazooka.
There was a flicker of movement on the street. Freeman rose to his feet and moved toward the window, his massive body forming a black silhouette in the thin light. Up the street, five men moved slowly toward us. Four of them formed an uneven picket line, with the fifth covering their back. These were, as I said before, thugs, not soldiers. They walked right up the middle of the street, apparently giving no thought to cover. They had torches attached to the barrels of their rifles, and they swept the ground before them with the beams of those torches. They made splendid targets.
Think those are the scouts or the hunting party?
What difference does it make?
Freeman opened the window and pointed his sniper rifle towards the men.
They'll be looking for us. However many men Callahan had in his gang with whatever weapons they have left, they will be looking for us.
Smashing a crippled gang is easier than smashing a whole one.
So, do we stay here tonight?
Freeman could hold down the fort, but one of us, meaning me, would need to check the street. I pointed this out, then ran up the stairs and slipped out of the house. I moved along the edge of the house, then crossed 20 feet of grass to crouch behind a hedge. Maybe 80 feet away, the men with their glaring flashlights marched up the street. Sprinting to a tree, then crawling behind a hedge, then kneeling beside a garage, I advanced along the street. From where I hid, I could see the dark barrel of Freeman's rifle poking out from the basement window. I recounted their flashlight beams. There were five of them. Freeman and I needed to kill these men so quickly that they would not make a sound. There might be another party of five searching the next street, and another five on the street after that. Apparently, Freeman knew this as well. They were so wrapped up in their search that they did not even notice when the man in the rear got hit. He had been walking a good 20 paces back from the rest of the group. No one even looked back for him. Freeman's next shot was not so skillful. Before the other men could react, I raised my particle beam pistol. The last man turned and tried to run. Others would come. If they did not locate us, they might burn the entire neighborhood down. We needed to put a couple of miles between us and Callahan's remaining soldiers before daybreak. We started down one street, saw men with lights, and then went down the next street. We zigged and zagged our way through the sleepy officer's suburb, hiding behind houses, and sometimes dashing into backyards. This went on for hours. The first signs of daylight showed on the horizon. The sky brightened behind distant buildings. We traveled through an exurb, then a suburb, and finally the metro, winding our way through alleys and small streets. We never did run into gangs as we passed through Safe Harbor. It took a day to reach the outer edge of the city, and another day to make our way down the highway. When we reached the vehicles we'd stolen, we hopped into Freeman's van and drove to the spaceport. I had not slept much since landing on New Columbia, neither had Freeman. We decided to rest for the night. He slept in his ship and I slept in the Starliner. As I made my bed, I found an old book with dried up leather binding. With all that had happened, I did not immediately recognize it. Then I saw the words, Personal Journal of Father David Sanjean, and remembered reading the book the night that Bryce Kleiber gave it to me. This was the diary of that Catholic priest who hated liberators but made an exception for Sergeant Shannon. I reread the passage and wondered what this man would have thought about me. Considering his prejudices, what would Father Sanjean have thought if he had lived to see the entire Republic fall? What would he think of the chaos in Safe Harbor? Liberators had not caused this entropy, though some had died trying to prevent it. As a priest, Sanjean would have agreed that evil can come from natural men. Would he also have agreed that good can come from synthetic soldiers? The next morning, Freeman joined me in the cockpit of the Starliner. He sat in his seat, staring out the window, and looking like an adult in a child's playhouse. It took a moment before I realized what had so captured his attention. He was looking at his plane, which he had owned for years. With the broadcast network out, his ride could no longer attempt anything more ambitious than continent hopping. I knew better than to inquire about it. Ask him how he felt, and Ray Freeman would simply stare at you.
Any suggestions about where to go?
Delphi.
Never heard of it.
You've heard of it. The Neo-Baptists renamed the place. Before my father arrived there, the planet was called Little Man.
Little Man?
I was headed there before you called me.
So much had happened over the last few days that I forgot all about Freeman's family. They had set up a colony on Little Man. The UA Navy had sent a fighter carrier to the planet to tell them to leave. And then the Republic went dark.
A fighter carrier dropped in on them. How long ago was that?
Or maybe 5 days. Why?
I might be wrong about this, but if I remember correctly, it takes over 100 hours to travel from the nearest broadcast disc to Little Man, and that is at top speed. If that carrier only left Little Man 4 days ago, it would not have made it to the discs in time to broadcast out.
Yeah, I figured that. Let's go.
Having a self-broadcasting ship was undeniably useful, and we soon found ourselves breaking into the atmosphere of Little Man. Seeing the planet again, my head filled with memories of the Marines who died in that awful battle. I remembered Captain Galen McKay, the personable young officer over my platoon on the Kamehameha. I remembered the ranks of idealistic Marines and the march that led to their deaths. Strange as it sounds, I felt an involuntary shiver. What I should have felt was anger.
When was the last time you saw your family?
It's been 5 years.
Well, this should be some homecoming.
They don't want me here.
We kept flying into the green and blue horizon. Using sensors to search for metal and heat, we located the colony in a plains area. They were building their settlement on the edge of a forest and not far from a clearwater lake. In the distance, a mountain range filled the horizon. It was not on the same continent on which we fought that final battle. The first thing we saw was acres and acres of plowed land. Beyond the fields was a small and primitive town that consisted of warehouses and unfinished apartment buildings. Even when the apartment buildings were complete, they would only be temporary shelters meant to hold people for days or weeks. Work had already begun on larger, more permanent buildings as well. Women and children in simple clothing emerged from the temporary shelters as we landed. Men in overalls came from the construction projects and from the fields. If there was one thing that stood out about the people on Little Man, it was their industrious nature. The people did not approach my ship, but huddled together inside the borders of their town. They did not seem scared. They simply stood in place, curious to see who we were.
Yes, the welcoming committee has arrived.
Freeman didn't say anything as he got up and moved to the hatch.
I should have known it was you.
Freeman did not answer the call. I stepped out of the ship. I guessed they were used to a 7-foot-tall black man, but the sight of a clone was strange and new. I turned to look at these people and got a jolt of my own. I had always taken it for granted that Ray Freeman was unique in the universe. He was, I thought, a one-of-a-kind, like me. It never occurred to me that he could have come from a colony of men and women similar to himself. The men and women of Delphi were very much like Freeman. They were tall and dark-skinned.
What are you doing here, son?
The man was tall and solidly built, but he looked underfed. He did not have Ray Freeman's broad wrestler's physique. His shoulders were square, his back was erect, and the parts of his arms that extended beyond the short sleeves of his shirt looked strong and well-formed. An even layer of gray Berber hair covered his head.
What are you doing here, Raymond?
Broadcast network was destroyed.
Destroyed?
I wanted to make sure you were okay.
By this time, however, the elder Freeman's attention was no longer on his son. He had turned to me.
You are a friend of Raymond's?
I nodded, wondering if Ray Freeman had ever really had a friend.
So how could anybody destroy the broadcast network?
It was a war. Some of the arms declared independence.
A civil war?
It's a civil war if you lose. It's a revolution when you win.
They won?
They destroyed the Mars broadcast station. Without the Mars discs, the entire system shut down.
For how long? How long before they fix the broadcast station?
They won't fix it.
Of course they'll fix it. They'll send over the fleet.
Earth doesn't have a fleet. The Earth fleet was defeated, and they can't send ships from other fleets without the discs.
Man has finally turned his back on us. God has cleared the way for us to stay in this promised land.
There were 113 people living on Delphi. I know the exact number because the entire population, or perhaps I should say congregation, assembled in their meeting house. The people sat on plastic benches. Archie Freeman, Ray Freeman's father, looked down on the congregation from behind a very plain pulpit over which hung a fiberglass cross.
My son says that we are in danger.
Now that he had washed up, the color of Archie Freeman's face was almost onyx. His skin had the texture of parched leather, his reward for 50 years of trying to start colonies on uninhabitable planets. Having finally landed on a productive planet with plenty of water and healthy soil, he did not want to leave.
Raymond, come up and speak your piece.
Ray, who had been sitting with a woman near the back, stood and walked to the front of the chapel.
Tell them what you told me, son.
There was a war. Four of the arms wanted to leave the Unified Authority. They had a fleet of self-broadcasting battleships. They attacked Earth and defeated the Earth fleet, and they destroyed the Mars broadcast station. Without the broadcast network, Navy ships cannot travel between systems. The ship that came here a few days ago was stuck out here too, and it will be back.
How can you know that?
It takes 4 or 5 days for a carrier to fly here from the disks. One that came here didn't have enough time to reach them before they went dark.
Raymond and his friend have offered to move us to another planet.
I had this strange feeling, like I was intruding on a family matter. I was an outsider. I quietly got up and left the meeting. It was early evening. The horizon showed orange and red, and the sky above me was white. A soft breeze blew in from the fields, carrying the scent of freshly turned soil and fertilizer. I stood and stared at the ground with its rows and furrows. Beyond the fields, a red and green forest stretched out as far as a man could see.
It looks so pretty at night. I almost forget all the sweat and hard work that goes into it.
It's beautiful.
The woman walked in my direction. She had brown skin. It was the same color as Ray Freeman's skin, but more tanned. Her skin was parched, but not as badly as Archie's.
You're not going to stay for the meeting?
They don't care what I have to say any more than they care what Ray has to say. We're pariahs, and decision-making is a job for God's elect. I'm Ray's sister, Marianne.
Wayson Harris. Why are you and Ray outcasts?
Raymond couldn't stand living in a religious colony. He never believed in Jesus, and he and Archie hated each other. When Raymond was old enough, he caught a ride on a supply ship and got as far away as he could. I think Archie was glad when he left. He wanted someone to follow in his footsteps and lead the armies of God. That wasn't Raymond.
Does Archie know what Ray does for a living?
We don't talk about that.
But you stayed. What makes you a pariah?
I stayed, but my husband didn't. I have a little boy named Caleb. He's in the meeting, sitting with his grandmother. I don't know how Jesus feels about divorced women, but I can tell you how the women on this planet feel about them. If I so much as talk to any of their men, tongues start wagging.
So you'd be glad to get off this planet?
Mr. Harris.
Call me Wayson.
Wayson, I don't think we'll leave this planet. Our little colony might not look like much, but we've worked night and day to build it. Delphi is a lot nicer than the other planets I've seen. Frankly, Wayson, starting all over again scares me more than the carrier out there.
You haven't been here that long. Your crops haven't even sprouted. How hard could it be to start over again?
That field? We worked on that field night and day. We still haven't cleared it properly. We got out most of the rocks, but there's a lot more we can do. We've planted almost every seed we have in that field, Mr. Harris.
Wayson.
If we leave that field... I can't speak for everyone, Wayson, but the people I have spoken with would rather die than leave. And it's not just that we're Neo-Baptists. We used to do this for the church, but that ended a long time ago. Now we're colonists first and Neo-Baptists second. The church wanted to create colonies just like the Catholics. That was their deal. Us? We wanted to make a home. Now that we finally have a planet that will sustain us, you can't really expect us to turn it over.
Why did your husband leave?
He thought there might be a better life on other worlds, so he flew off on a supply ship, just like Raymond. He asked me to come with him, but I didn't want to go. I believe God wanted us to build a colony. I had my boy, my Caleb. I wanted him to grow up in a righteous colony. I believe that God would bring us to our promised land, our Goshen. I believe he has. Do you believe in God, Mr. Harris?
I don't know if I believe in God. And I don't know if he believes in me.
It was not love at first sight. Probably wasn't even love. But I felt attracted to Marianne. I liked her.
It doesn't seem like anybody here knows about the war.
We hear things. Well, truth be told, we all heard things. The missionaries that flew us here told us about it, but it didn't sound serious. It didn't sound like more than a little uprising.
You never followed the war on the media link?
And what would that be?
What would what be?
You said something about following the war on something or other.
The media link? That's the news source.
I can't say I've ever heard of it.
It's too late now. It receives communication signals sent through the broadcast network. You do know about the broadcast network?
Yes, I know about the broadcast network.
When they destroyed the network, they shut down communications as well as travel. Close as I can figure, it would take a laser signal 70,000 years to get from Earth to Delphi. Without the broadcast network, they might as well be sending smoke signals.
So it's all true. The entire Republic is shut down.
Everyone is on their own. It's just that some planets are better off than others.
So why did you come here? You have that self-broadcasting ship. You can go anywhere.
I asked Ray where he wanted to go, and he said he wanted to come here.
And you went where he asked. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge also. Your people shall be my people. You're a modern version of Ruth, Mr. Harris.
Maybe we should look in on the meeting. I don't want to start tongues wagging.
Are you worried about my reputation? Don't worry about me. Those tongues are already wagging. That's how life goes on a small planet.
How did it go?
I spoke to Freeman as we settled down to sleep in the Starliner. Archie could not find beds for us. He could not find sheets for us, but he did have pillows.
They don't want to leave. They think they can talk their way out of this.
They want to reason it out with a fighter carrier?
They think God delivered them here. You landed on an engineered planet once, didn't you?
Ezra Cree. That's where we caught Klein. You were there, remember?
No. An unpopulated one.
Ronan Minor.
It wasn't called something Cree?
The term Cree denoted a planet with an engineered atmosphere.
It was a shitty place. What do you think is happening on Earth?
Depends on who comes out on top. If the Confederate arms win, they'll fly in armies. The outer arms always had good ground forces, they just couldn't protect them. If the Mogats made out, it'll be worse. The Mogats, they don't care about colonizing. They don't want to occupy Earth. All they want is to erase every vestige of the Unified Authority.
It's only been a few days. The Mogats and the Confederates may not be through killing each other yet.
Harris, you think we could relocate these folks on Ronan Minor?
They wouldn't like it. It was a jungle, and the only life on it is cockroaches and rats.